Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, and Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, believe it or not, set up in 2002. This week, access to children and the family courts. Also, miscarriages of justice are growing in Britain in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not, to the rescue comes Victims Unite website and editor Sabine McNeil. Plus, our weekly news and disabled people's update with Jason Yannakopoulos. As well as the unforgettable Jeff Sparks with his What's On Guide. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. First of all, though, joining me as usual on the telephone is Sabine McNeil from Victims Unite. Hi, Sabine.
Hi, Tony.
Now, this week on your website, you've got, I believe, something to do with who's ruling Britain, the MPs or the judges. So do you want to give us a quick shortcut to whatever the answer is?
Well, in our experience, ours meaning victims of white-collar crimes, judges make things up as they go along. And I don't think there's much of a connection with Parliament, and Theresa May used that immigration disaster, I suppose, as a way of blaming judges. But in my view, judges are much, much, much worse with respect to family law, because that was what the immigration was about. She feels that criminals should not be allowed to use their right to family to stay if they're foreign. Well, nobody looks at, or not enough people look at, all of those families that are destroyed by foreigners being targeted and put into prison, for example. And judges just sanction what social services are doing. So I don't have any reason to have any respect for judges, whereas do have reason to believe that MPs hopefully can sort things out. I mean, I only work with those whom I communicate with and whom I relate to and whom I treat as gold dust. I don't like generalizations, but with judges, I'm afraid I haven't had any positive experience.
Well, I mean, certainly because you're dealing quite a lot, if not all the time, with miscarriages of justice of various sorts, Sabine. But, I mean, what you're saying is the opposite to what the entire mainstream press has been saying, television, radio and newspapers this week, saying that actually what Theresa May has been doing is trying to interfere with the courts, interfere with the judges. So you put a different view, would you?
Well, she puts it forward. She criticizes judges, thank God, but for a different reason, and if not the wrong reason, in my view, because she feels the judges are trying to keep foreigners in the country, if and as and when and because they're, even though they are criminals, and they are using their right to family law. But at the same time, I can list enough judges who are destroying family and do not stick to it. So in a way, it's her approach is just not the right one. It's too superficial. It just splits hairs a little bit. It doesn't go to the root of the problem, being that any judge can do whatever they like. That is the real problem. And it's not just immigration. It's not just the use of that particular aspect of that particular law.
Well, this specific story is about deportation, isn't it? And, I mean, what's been happening, apparently, is that people who are migrants, immigrants in Britain, are being stopped from being deported, even though they're criminals. Now, you know, this, it would have thought, is something which politicians are trying to get brownie points and votes from saying something. So, I mean, is your... Do you think that there's any truth to that allegation? That this is something that the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday are constantly saying, is that, you know, we are
fighting in the courts between, on one hand, the laws of human rights, saying that someone who's a criminal who hasn't got a British citizenship has rights to stay here, and on the other hand, saying, well, I mean, basically, because they're not a British citizen, they shouldn't have the right to stay.
Yeah, but you see, this is where I find it very, very sad that and how the mainstream media use emotive issues like racism, effectively, or just the fear of foreigners, in not the right context. Because as much as there are these foreign criminals, I'm afraid to say there are white collar criminals who destroy the family lives of foreigners and who put them into prison. I got a phone call today from one woman whom I visited in prison. She had her 4 children taken, and she was in Holloway for 11 months, and she's crying out for some kind of justice and some kind of help. So, you know, I mean, maybe in the end law needs to be made by statistics. And one has to decide how many foreign criminals there are and how many white-collar criminals are destroying foreign families.
I mean, at the end of the day, how accountable, in your experience, are judges if it looks like they're making arbitrary decisions of one sort or another? Is there any kind of accountability?
As far as I know, not. I think that is precisely the problem, and that's why I think Theresa May is right in saying the judges should respect that Parliament is the legislator. But in a way, it just appears that there is no law anywhere, everywhere. You know, anybody just makes things up as they go along. It doesn't matter what rule, what guidance, what guidelines there is. And I found one nice blog comment today that if in a true civilization one just needs one law, don't do any harm. And this is, of course, the problem. Anybody and everybody does harm anywhere, and in abusing power. And judges abuse their power their way. But there's hope, I must say. I'm going along this new judge who is it's the judge who is the new president of the family division. Manby is his name. He said, and there's a precedent case, that it's a dreadful thing for taking children at birth. Dreadful for the father, the mother, and for the baby. And that's where I want to see whether I can get children back who've been taken at birth.
That sounds pretty horrific. I mean, the idea that the parents, the mother or whoever, don't even get a chance to prove that they can be a decent parent.
So this is exactly the thing. This is exactly where we are helping. And a mother on Monday, she's appealing. She cried out, I didn't put in a comment on Victims Unite, and is appealing after she discovered that her lawyer isn't working in her interest. And that's precisely the situation, over and over again. So, you know, whether it's judges, whether it's lawyers, of course, I only get the bad ones. I can't tell what the ratio is between good and bad. But it can't be that brilliant, given the kind of comments I get on my petitions as well.
Well, I hate to say this, but we've got another couple of cases to talk about now, Sabine. If you don't mind hanging on, I've got a couple of people in the studio who we're going to hear from now. Firstly, from Ben Luton. Ben, hi and welcome to Dialect.
How you doing, Tony?
Your situation, you don't have access to your child. Can you just tell us how that happened?
Yes, essentially, my little girl was born a year ago. She'll have her first birthday on the 3rd of March this year. And essentially, my ex-partner seems to have had a concerted plan from the start to have a child and keep her and basically take me out of the loop at every point. This was pre-birth, during birth, and post. It's been nearly a year now, and I've seen her for a total of about an hour and a half over the entire year. It's horrible to go through, but you fight your best you can. And at the moment, I'm, you know, it's still an ongoing battle. It still hasn't gone to court.
I mean, for some people, maybe. I mean, can you just give us an idea of what sort of relationship you had that child was born into?
Amazingly enough, it was actually born into a really loving relationship at the time. My ex-partner and I were best friends for over 12 years. So you like to think that you have a kind of stable foundation on which to base something. And while we hadn't planned on having a child, it came about, and we both made the decision that if we stuck together and, you know, we were both smart enough decent people to bring up a child in this rather horrific world as it is at the moment. And, you know, we thought we could do it. And we came to an agreement between the two of us. And it was, well, shall we say, silently reneged by her.
Okay, so just give us an idea of the first inkling that you had that maybe there was going to be a problem here and that you weren't going to be able to bring up the child together, that there, you know, there was going to be some kind of separation between you and the child and your partner at the time.
Yeah, I'd say it was around about sort of the 6th, 7th month mark when my ex-partner was finding it very difficult to just adjust to how the two of us were going to do this. She was making just outrageous suggestions for me to change my life, and essentially...
Well, hang on a minute. One person's outrageous might be somebody else's perfectly normal, so give us an idea of what she was saying.
Well, the outrageousness was that I was to essentially get everything in my life into order in a couple of month period. Now, I understand, obviously, you know, coming up to being a budding father, etc., I needed certain responsibilities, which was to obviously get a hold of a job, hold down, things like this. And at the time, you know, I was quite a frequent recreational marijuana user. And these were perfectly normal things for my ex-partner to turn around and say, you know, you need to change these things in order to be a decent dad. And I was like, absolutely, fantastic, brilliant. However, these requests were getting more diluted. They were, you know, you're spending too much time out. You need to be doing this more. You need to spend more. She was changing me. She was essentially locking me down and saying, listen, I'm pregnant. You have to do everything I say. And I really did try and bend. I really did try and bend as much as I could. And it didn't matter what I did. It was never good enough. And she terminated the relationship about 7 months in. And this was really the time when I thought to myself, it's going to go south. I mean, there really is no saving it from this point. She's 2 months away from giving birth. She's already requesting that she doesn't want to have anything to do with me verbally, physically, anything at all. No contact. No contact with her family. No contact with my family. Absolute, complete and utter disconnection just over 6 months in.
So, I mean, had your parents, your family, and her parents, her family, had they actually been in contact during your quite long relationship? Because that's often the sort of background to a good relationship into the future, isn't it?
Absolutely.
When the families are actually quite friendly with each other,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, when they get along, when you see the two sets of mum and dad in the room, you know, conversing and everything's going well, that's exactly what I thought it was, and there was a good foundation originally. Quite ironically enough, my ex-partner requested that my mother be her birth partner. So while she was finishing her relationship with me, my mother was trying to mediate the situation by, you know, honouring her requests, becoming a birthing partner, and doing what she could to make my ex-partner comfortable through the transition and the birth of my daughter. Well, my mother did this because she's a good person and all the rest of it, and as soon as the baby was born, my ex-partner disavowed my mother, along with myself.
So what legal routes have you been down, if any, and what efforts have you made to amicably get access to your daughter?
Originally, it was going the normal route, which was to give the mother time. I don't know if anybody's actually aware of this, but a lot of people these days like to ride the whole postnatal depression train a lot of the time, and they're like, listen, if the mother is doing anything wacky at all, anything, you know, within the first couple of months, just basically blame it on postnatal and then try and assess the situation in a couple of months. So that's what I did. I gave her time and I was hoping that she would come around amicably so that we could actually, you know, come to an understanding. And it just never came. After about 3 months of this, I decided to take the legal aid route because I just couldn't afford private representation legally or lawfully, whichever way you swing. But I couldn't afford it. And I was absolutely forced to come out of a very good job in a decent wage, decent career, to get a hold of some legal representation of some sort and start this battle. And it's literally been going on from that point, from about sort of May last year.
Okay, so what court appearances or what's, you know, how has that actually transpired in decisions in the judicial process then?
Absolutely nothing so far. It's just been dragged along from pillar to post. There have been a couple of setbacks in the fact that I had to get re-employed again and lose my legal aid for a month because my mother... you know, temporarily lost her job, so I had to help out with her financial constraints. But once I got back on the ladder for legal aid, it's just been from pillar to post. It's been bureaucracy and red tape, stipulations for requirements to actually get the legal aid itself. You have to tick all the boxes, you have to be eligible, you have to do this, you can't do that. And in this time at all, on top of everything else, I've just had a lot of trouble with the police.
So is the police?
Oh yes, many times. Since this time last year, roughly, I've been arrested probably a dozen times. I've had the police called on me for walking past cul-de-sacs. I've been arrested for staring at white vans. I've been arrested for kneeling down in spa.
Hang on a minute. I mean, is this related then
to
your ex-partner and, you know, around your ex-partner, around your ex-partner's house,
Absolutely.
This kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, she lives less than 20 feet away from my front door. You know, she actually moved in. I'd lived on my street in my place for nearly 15 years. She moved in and I helped her move in to a place just behind my house. And of course, with her being in such close proximity to my house, the ratio for having incidences out in the street and near the corner shop and such as this, you know, they're going to be higher than two other normal people that live apart. And of course, this has come down to that.
Crikey. So actually arrested? I mean, have you spent the night in a police cell?
I have, yes.
And what's the police's reasoning behind this? And what actual laws have you been arrested for? What, you know, and actually, has there been consequences? Have you been in front of the magistrates and have they fined you? What's that all about?
Well, essentially, no. They can't charge me because I haven't done anything wrong. They're arresting me under the pretense of harassment, which is what they will always arrest an individual under if they believe that there is any type of communication between two parties that isn't warranted. You know, they'll always go forth and they'll arrest under harassment. However, Gwent police like to be seen to be doing, quote, positive action, which is what they're calling their new drive against, shall we say, domestic abuse, etc., etc.
So, I mean, is there any evidence that there has been domestic abuse?
Absolutely
which this
no.
harassment is related to, then? I mean, have you done this?
I've done absolutely nothing. I believe that the first time was to give a quick phone call to my ex-partner to ask when family mediation might be coming about. So that was simply to request a date and time.
Wouldn't it have been wiser to say, for example, get your solicitor or some other
Well, this is it. I
party.
Wasn't eligible for legal aid at the time because there were so many different aspirations for me actually chasing legal aid. I was trying to get it as hard as I could, but in the meantime, I was trying to be amicable, as in I might send a text message, one single text message, just saying, you know, this is what I want. I would like you to hurry up and please stipulate a time and a date so that we can get family mediation on the go. We don't need to go to court. We don't need solicitors. You know, if you believe that I'm the father and I believe you're the mother, then surely we can sit down in a room and you can give me a time and a date with supervised or non-supervised access. It's very, very simplistic. There's never been any physical, verbal, domestic abuse of any kind ever. But this is where we're at right now.
Well, sounds pretty shocking. Also, I'm joined by a former candidate for Bristol Mayor. That's Tony Britt. Hi, Tony, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Right, Tone, you're in the same sort of situation, I believe, aren't you, without having access to your daughter. Just give us an idea of, you know, how that happened and how you've got the first inkling that maybe, you know, your daughter wasn't going to be available for you to go and visit at all.
Well, where do I start? All I can say is when it all happened, you're always beating yourself up on the past and what happened yesterday. I'll start off saying, when I first met Kathy, I loved her when I met her. I loved her when I married her. I loved her when she had Millie Mae, and I still loved her, right? So I don't really want to talk bad, but the system makes you talk bad about your partner. And it is anti-man. Now, when I had an inkling that Kathy was going to do what she did, her son moved in. Two nights later, after Kathy asked me to do some alterations to the house so her son could move in, she got up and left after she promised me. But with Kathy, because I knew her past from her other relationships, she had two other children and three other relationships, her reputation was that she ran away when she had an argument with her boyfriend to her sister's. And she'd done the same again. But when I first met her, I asked her, could she promise me that she won't do the same to me as what she'd done with her partnership in the past. So for a long while, she was going to a mentor or some description to talk about her past. And I blame this on her past. No one's told her what she was doing in the past to her other relationship was wrong. She, you know what I mean? So she always seen running to her sister was an answer. Yeah, and then what made it worse was I went to my sister's house and on a Sunday dinner, and my sister was telling me something what happened in the past with my dad. So I, as a messenger, repeated it to my dad, saying, oh, do you know, my sister's husband, he's going to take you to court for something what happened in the past. And the next thing I know, my dad went over to Cafe's place, shouted and bawled at her, and a year later I found out I got a divorce that I wasn't even invited to.
So you didn't even know. So you were married. How old was your daughter Millie, you know, when you last saw her then?
Well, I was the main guardian. I had paperwork saying that I was the main guardian. You know, I got her out of bed. I put her to bed. I took her to school, like when I used to work in the community.
So was your wife actually working pretty yeah. much full time then? And you were like almost like a house husband?
I was an house husband. I was the house husband. I did all the clinging. And, you know, after Brave and what happened with that situation, I said, oh, I ain't going to work again. And because Kathy wasn't very maternal at all, like, you know, everybody different. I've always wanted children. And I said, yeah, I'll bring Millie Mia. And I loved it. Every minute of it.
So how old was your daughter at this stage? Because you had been taking her to school, did you say?
Yeah. 3 and a half she was when she left. Last time I seen my daughter was 3 and a half. And that's just over 3 and a half years ago.
So what's the situation now?
Well, no one will talk to me. The system is so anti-man.
Have you been to court? I mean, the thing is,
I wasn't even invited.
So there has been a court hearing about your daughter, but yeah. you were not invited to it.
I had two phone calls from the police station down in Biddeford to say, stay away, right? So I stayed away. I took all her luggage down there, everything. And, you know, I was a proper gentleman. Try to keep calm about it, even if I did have nightmares about it. And I heard through my auntie, who lives in Norwest, told me Kathy told her I was divorced, and so she told me the court said, so say she got the divorce from. Now, because I couldn't afford a solicitor and I couldn't get legal aid and I was made homeless, Debbie the vicar from Barton Hill, she represented me as a legal person. Now, Kathy's solicitor wouldn't talk to Debbie the vicar, and she contacted the courts. I sent £5 through the post, and I found out, let's say, the beginning of November. At the end of November, I had a letter from the court saying I was divorced on the 28th of September, and you got 6 weeks to contest. I don't even know what I done wrong.
So you were divorced without you even really
knowing
what had happened?
I didn't have a say in nothing. Nothing at all.
Well, this is amazing. Anyway, still, hopefully, there is Sabine. Are you there still?
Yeah.
Sabine, I mean, from these two cases, you know, I don't know how much you can say in any detail that might be of comfort to our guests, but it does sound as if the real law is something along the lines of possession being 9/10 of the law.
It's certainly true that I've heard, observed, many, many anti-men style situations as well, and I have no idea why that is so, should be so, and has come to this, and why I mean, there's a big campaign, Fathers for Justice, out there, and I just don't understand it. I don't know why this bias should be there in this way. I mean, because at the same time, there's certainly an institutional bias towards paedophiles. Why it should be there towards women, on the other hand, I can't explain it.
But isn't it, I mean, isn't it more simple than that, maybe, that that actually this is about who has possession of the child, and the legal system is a little bit clunky, doesn't work very well, and therefore, if you've got possession of the child, then that is 9/10 of the law, and that the law isn't actually rather ineffective.
I guess that's the way of putting it, yes, wherever. And this applies also to all of those kids who are in the possession of social services. Once they've got them, how on earth do you get them back again? Once whoever has them, how on earth do you get them back? I suppose that is the real message, whether it's fathers or mothers. It's maybe not the true differentiation to make.
Can I just ask you, Ben Luton, we heard from you first, you know, do you find any sort of similarities between your experience and what you've heard from Tony Britt there?
I can't help but think that obviously Tony's case is a lot worse than mine. His duration has gone on a lot longer, and I know what I feel like when I wake up in the morning, when I go to sleep at night, and, you know, that's after a year. I can't imagine what it's like after 3 and a half. So I guess the same correlations I could put across as the fact that we both don't have access to our daughters and we're finding it very difficult to get access to them. But it's a scary reminder to me. I mean, I'm sat here and I'm looking at Tony and I can't help but think that if my situation doesn't change, I don't know where I might be 2 years from now. I mean, I hope to God that my situation does change, but I feel for Tony so much because I literally cannot imagine the strength it must take to go through what he's gone through.
So Tony, just tell us how it's affected you. I mean, you know, you obviously still do think about your daughter because you had a very long, very, very close, caring relationship with her for, what is it, nearly 4 years?
Wow, nightmares. Nightmares is unreal. Like, you might see Kathy in a dream or Millie Mae or, you know, it is unreal. It just, you can't sleep because you're too frightened to dream. And, you know, I enjoyed being a dad. I really did. And it just seems so unfair that the system won't listen to both parties.
I mean, if it would listen, what would you say?
Well, shared parenting is currently going through Parliament, but it's just so removed from the reality of the real parents who actually are yearning to get contact. It is just so dreadful. I mean, all of these kids who will try to get justice later, it's so cruel, I can't.
I mean, one would imagine that once the children are grown up, they will want to have some sort of contact with the father. I mean, is that your experience, Sabine?
Yes, of course. I mean, there's also all of the most adopted children want to look for their birth parents. So, I mean, it's about, you know, finding one's roots. It's about finding one's identity. One does not want to, but then one doesn't know, you know, what kind of stories the mothers tell their kids about their dads now.
I mean, in your experience, how do the family courts actually work? So I know that they operate differently to, say, the county court or magistrates' courts.
Well, the big difference is that they are in secret, because it's supposedly always in the interest of the child that they remain anonymous.
But isn't that correct? I mean, surely that is—it's right that you know, this is—you shouldn't really be exposing the child to public scrutiny of its you know, problems at that very young age. And there's an argument that says that, you know, this is really, the courts have to be secret to protect the child.
Well, yes, and I mean, Ian Josephs, who has been watching these kinds of stories for 40 years or so, says he in principle he doesn't mind that secrecy, but when the secrecy is abused, then of course it's really, really wrong, and I guess that's what things boil down to, the abuse of power. I've just seen for the first time a United Nations text about the abuse of power and the rights of victims, but all of these words just mean nothing in the reality of hearings. I mean, I just find there is a huge difference between the paper reality that is being created as the basis for any kind of court hearings and the actual reality of the people. I mean, the young mother that I'm helping, she really had to learn to deal with papers. And I suspect that's true for many, many, many people. But then what happens is sort of decided behind closed doors anyway, between the solicitors and the judges.
Okay. Now, I think there's probably the best way to finish with my two guests. I'll start with you, Ben Luton, is to ask you, if you had your way, what do you think would be a kind of fair process? Because obviously you don't feel that you've had that. So what kind of process between you and your partner and your daughter would work, do you think, and be a fair process?
I think just access to begin with. You know, I've never had the opportunity to be a father, and it's very important for me to be a father. You know, everybody's got, you know, whatever in the cupboard, and one of mine is to be a good father. I need to be a good father. It's absolutely essential that I do that, and I haven't been given the opportunity. So what would I consider to be fair? Access, any kind, just anything. Just let me see her for a couple of hours in a room. You could have armed guards with guns to my head. I don't care. You know, just give me something.
Okay, and what, once a month, something like that, once a week? What, you know, just what, as a sort of basic minimum?
Well, we could start off with maybe an hour a week, you know, and I'll go from there. I mean, I want full and complete access to my daughter. I'm not going to get it, so I will renegotiate to half and half, and then if I can't get that, I'll go down, but just give me something.
There's something strange, isn't there, about the idea that you would like to almost sort of touch your daughter and love your daughter, and yet
arrested. I'm being put in prison cells. I'm being given genetically modified food. I'm in. It's quite funny, actually. I'll tell us just for 10 seconds. When I was arrested and kept in the police cell a couple of weeks ago, I was in there, and I have quite a serious injury to my right arm. Now, they wouldn't get me a doctor. They wouldn't give me painkillers. They wouldn't give me anything. They arrested me under a false pretense. They brought me in, they detained me, and they kept me in a cell for 17 hours in agony. And then I was let go without charge because I hadn't done anything wrong. I knelt down in a spa and attempted to look at my daughter, and that was enough.
So where you know, what was the circumstance? You knelt down? How do you mean?
I walked into my local spa, and my ex-partner
was there.
This is
a sort of grocery shop. Okay, not a jacuzzi.
You don't have spas in Bristol, do you? Right, okay. yeah, the spa is like the local sort of, you know, 7-Eleven, Kmart or whatever. And essentially, you can go down the road and pick up all your groceries or whatever from, like, you know, like a Tesco Express. They call it spa. So I went down the road just to get some milk, you know, a couple of basics. And I'm walking around the alleys, and she's there. And I try and keep my composure, but I can't. It's not that I did anything wrong. I didn't speak out. I didn't get physical or anything like that. I knelt down because I felt something inside of myself. I had to kneel down. I had to see my daughter. I couldn't even remember what she looked like. And she's changing every day, being the age she is. And I knelt down and I went to speak to her. And my ex-partner just looked at me and went, no.
And did your ex-partner actually phone the police at that point then? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. She sequestered the CCTV from the spa to be analysed by the police to say, oh, well, Ben did communicate with me. And when he communicated with me, it was you know, it was horrible. And what he said is disgusting. And he's ruining my life. And he's communicating all the time. And I don't want him to communicate with me. And you're like, well, just be reasonable. And I won't have to request to see my own daughter, you crazy thing.
Okay, and also you, Tony Britt, if you could have some sort of change in the way things operate, you know, what do you think would be a fair process that would give you some kind of fair, at least a little bit of access to your daughter?
I would love to be able to sit in a room, just me and Kathy, and talk about what happened and how we could put things right. Maybe like Robin Moss can make both sides equal instead of one-sided, because it's been one-sided all the way.
Okay, and finally, Sabine, maybe you could just give our guests an inkling of anything positive that's coming out from the family court system at the moment.
Actually, the only only positive is the new president, who says it's dreadful if a child is taken at birth. And so I wonder whether the access to your daughter, and it could be at least because you virtually haven't seen her since her birth, but that is unclear. But I suspect they'll treat it differently, fathers and mothers, from that point of view. But that to me is the only sign of hope that I'm seeing. Except now there is also a Supreme Court hearing where people will decide something about where the social services will be scrutinized a little bit more. But I don't really feel I can help your two fathers. I just feel terribly, terribly sorry for them.
Well, anyway, thank you, Sabine McNeil, Ben Luton and Tony Britt. Thanks very much for that discussion.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. It's called The Maltese Double Cross and was never repeated, but can be watched online. It represents compelling evidence of a secret motive for the US CIA to have blown up Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on 21st of December 1988. Alan also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for BBC Time Watch, which was shown to stunned audiences in 1992. That programme documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof and even the IRA. Let's think about the Guildford bombings and the Birmingham bombings. They're still unsolved. Frankovich died of a suspicious heart attack in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. Alongside the feature films of Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentaries give us a deep insight into the criminal side of Western intelligence agencies such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad,
and NATO intelligence. All these secret political operations being deniable, but then carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released the film In Company Business, all about the CIA. Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo, and he spoke to Alternative View at the time of the Vietnam War.
Is that they really didn't want the facts to come out that they were not winning the war in Vietnam, just like they don't want the facts to come out that the government they're supporting in El Salvador is losing the war.
Right.
Because the whole basis of this is to rather than do, you know, what any American president should do when this country's in a crisis, is to get on television and say, this is what we have to do there. We just discovered that the Soviet Union is going to invade El Salvador, and that we have to do this, that, and the other thing. No, what they do is, because they know that's not true. And in terms of Vietnam, for instance, one of the persons I interviewed in the film, and this is interesting, if you just remember the recent El Salvador election results, his name is Paul Sackler. He was the chief of the Vietnam desk when Colby made his first tour in Vietnam. And he was reading to me cables of how the Vietnamese intelligence service was a completely owned adjunct of the CIA then and to the end. They were rigging the elections. He had these cables coming in, you know, were coming in there. His reports from his people. And so, I mean, there you have, this is Diem, who the CIA later arranges to eliminate.
Right.
And here you have, you know, a government which invites the United States in, which the United States, first of all, brings to power. And so when it's like inviting yourself in, you know, it's like having yourself
and
a big
then manipulating the elections.
They're manipulating the elections so that you can bring in someone who will invite you in and make sure that someone who wants to kick you out. So it wouldn't surprise me at all in terms of the Sam Adams story. But the problem is, how do you get accurate intelligence then if you're discouraging anyone who is trying to be honest and report information which he believes an American president should know in order precisely to preclude what happened in Iran, was, you know, finally, I mean, the relationship that the United States have with Iran are non-existent because there's 30 years of secret history.
This is an important point, that the CIA is not really an intelligence agency. They're not providing accurate intelligence, which they're supposed to do by their charter. Rather, they're an arm of covert action. And isn't there something like six major issues where the CIA had either inaccurate information, or if they did, in the case of Iran and some Vietnam reports, they were at one place in the bureaucracy kept from the political decision people. So they've really been a major failure as an intelligence agent.
No, because you see, because intelligence really is not what concerns, because you're dealing, you know, at the top level, you're dealing with economic interests. You're dealing with, why should the President of the United States listen to some little flunky CIA analyst who says, look, this thing in Iran is going to blow up in our faces, people are just going to get mad at us, they're going to kick us out, this whole thing is going to go to hell. When, at the same time, somebody's calling up and saying, look, you know, the Shah's our friend, and none of that, but we have major dealings, you know, we're getting $300 million by selling them helicopters. And you see, you have the irony that Iran is fighting the war with Iraq now with arms that the Shah bought. And the United States, you have every reason to believe that they're encouraging the Iraqis, but because, you know, they see the Iranian process as very dangerous because it's a nationalist process. And if it spreads over into Saudi Arabia and the Saudis realize that that the kings of Saudi Arabia have sold them down the river and will keep on selling them down the river forever, That'll have an impact.
That was US filmmaker Alan Frankovich speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS video news magazine. That's how it was in the 1980s. Alternative Views, which you can view online on YouTube now, way back in 1982. More next week and subsequent weeks from Alan Frankovich. So now I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Now, Oscar.
Oscar Pistorius, yes. I had a feeling when I came here that we'd come to this. Yes, it's it really is a tragic event for those not familiar with the story, which has been blowing across news for just about the last 48 hours or so.
Most of this week, isn't it?
Yeah, Oscar Pistorius Oscar Pistorius shot his girlfriend, South African model Reva Steenkamp, in their home in Pretoria. It is actually a really tragic case from personal, you know, from this perspective, because Oscar Pistorius is an absolute hero for a lot of the disabled community.
Just tell us a little bit more about him. I mean, I don't really follow the Paralympics and that kind of thing. Well, what are his main sports and what does he actually do? I feel like I should know this, but yeah, as someone who deals more with sort of hard news, the sporty side passes me by a lot of the time.
Oscar Pistorius is a Paralympic athlete, the Blade Runner, they call him. He has prosthetic legs, and he took part in the 100 metres, 200 metres, and 400 metres at the Paralympics. And won gold in all of those in Beijing, and didn't actually manage to replicate that in London. He did win gold, I think, in 200. But the reason that he became so popular and famous, the reason him specifically, is he was the first amputee to participate in both the Paralympics and the actual Olympics.
Well, isn't there a little bit of controversy about those sorts of prosthetic legs? Because, you know, they can be designed with springs and goodness knows what, so that you could actually outrun an able-bodied runner, probably. And it's all in the design, isn't it? One set of legs might give you a speed of 50 miles an hour, for goodness sake.
Well, it's not designed that way. It's designed to function as normal legs would if they're running. I mean, they don't have an extra motor that helps you to go faster. That's ridiculous, but it's all about the main controversy is about height, about whether there is a height advantage depending on how long you have your blades or not. But Oscar was cleared to run in the Olympics, and he ran, he got to the final, didn't get a medal, but he did quite well. So for all this to happen in South Africa recently, it's almost crushing. I mean, particularly for South Africa, who've now got a great athlete potentially facing jail term for what is potentially murdering his partner. I mean, we don't know that for sure. His claim is that he mistook her for a burglar.
So, I mean, how do you think that's going to affect the Paralympic movement generally? I mean, you say it's a little bit disappointing, and it's a bit of a morale hit, isn't it?
I think it may be a slight more, particularly in South Africa, but I hope it doesn't affect it too much. I don't think it will, and probably not in the UK, because we have quite a few established Paralympians now. We have David Weir, who won 4 gold medals at London. We have Sarah Storey, who's won gold medals at the last 4 Paralympics running, both swimming and cycling. So we've got Ellie Simmons, that's more swimmer who's really quite like a rocket. And we've got a good few coming through, so hopefully the Oscar Pistorius case won't overshadow the next Paralympics.
Well, one of the big things is, of course, how well funded the Paralympics is in Britain after the Games. Do you think that the cuts that are affecting, I mean, we've had the strike at the BBC, for example, this week. Almost everywhere there seems to be cuts. There's cuts in the local authority spending, national government spending. And the only thing that isn't being cut is the bankers' bonuses.
Well, that is true. That is true. The bankers certainly seem to have their way. Yes, the main problem is that some sports have received an 100% cut in funding, such as basketball. I mean, I don't know whether that includes wheelchair basketball. I'm assuming that includes wheelchair basketball as well. The Paralympics movement tends to be somewhat separate from the Olympics movement, but even then there will be cuts. And indeed, they're saying that there's some Olympians, Paralympians, I was reading this on the BBC today, who are forced to give up their sport because there's no longer any funding in it.
Look, before we get totally off the subject of the cuts, you're half Greek anyway. What's yes. going to be going on in Greece? Because it's gone off the headlines, hasn't it, Greece? Athens, there was riots and goodness knows what else. Has it sort of died down, or has it just disappeared off the news?
I think it's more it's disappeared off the news. I don't think it's died down much at all. I mean, we still have issues in Greece with... we still have protests, we still have...
I mean, you've got the rise of the far right, for example.
That really is worrying. The rise of Golden Dawn, the far right party, who briefly at least had a seat in the had one person on the cabinet, which was really worrying. It's It's interesting. It's tenuous time for Greece, and it'll be interesting to see how far we can go on like this. I mean, for somebody who is Greek, it's a shame, but do you want to start?
I think the reasons it's really handy, you know, you being here, Jason, is because you can give us maybe an idea about what might be happening to Britain in the years to come, because there's all this talk about Britain as well losing its credit rating. It does seem there's this sort of death spiral right across the continent and the Western world to do with debt. Everyone is being dragged down one by one. It's just that it's handy to know what's happening to Greece, because we may be there in a year's time, or maybe less, or maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, it is. It is stunning. It all comes from the 2008 credit crunch, where I think everything just went down the plug hole pretty much. Well, that might have been 2009. I'm not sure.
Well, the 2008 crash, really. Yeah. It would have been a crash if they hadn't been the banks hadn't been rescued, and maybe it would have been better to let them crash.
Well,
we would certainly have been well into some sort of recovery of some kind now if they had been.
Well, I think that's it. I think the notion that some banks are too big to fail is. It's a nothing case. I mean, no bank should be too big to fail,
and no banker too big to jail.
I like that. Very good.
Also, you've been up at UWE this week, haven't you? Looking at pears.
Not this week, but last week. Pears.
Oh, last week. Okay, sorry. Yeah. And pears.
Pears is politics and international relations, and UWE, University of England, has come to the decision to close these two popular and influential courses. The reason I haven't actually heard the official reason from UWE themselves, but the reason I was told by the former student union president was due to the lack of numbers of responses to the National Student Survey, which is compulsory to be filled in at the end of your final year. I mean, I did it.
Oh, right. So they're saying that it's the students that are saying that they don't actually want to do these sorts of courses. They'd rather be doing things like business courses.
No. Well, no. It's the university saying that's a reflect they get from the students. How much of that is true, I don't know. The university is definitely taking a decision over the last few years to close down humanities courses and focus on law and business.
Oh, that's a shame, because I did a humanities degree. I quite enjoyed it. You know, it's a broad sort of artsy with a little bit of, I mean, a bit of history, a bit of geography. I really enjoyed it doing that.
Yeah, it's made to the government. The government takes a view that the courses that are worth it are the courses that are going to make money, of course, which you'd expect from a conservative Liberal Democrat coalition.
Also, a fire on the front page of the Western Daily Press this week.
Yes, very much so.
What's that about?
Access to fall on fire stations, as it says, and that means that a sizable number of fire stations in the West Country are to close because of lack of funds, basically to save money.
It's week after week there's more, isn't there, if it's not the high street shops that are closing. I wonder, and this is, I'll put this to you, right? I wonder if it wasn't for all these big companies, big multinationals that are doing so well, if you were to take them out of the equation, the whole of the rest of the economy is going down almost like a one in two hill, isn't it? It's going straight down, the rest of it.
Well, yeah, you could say that. I mean, the public services are taking the biggest hit of all, really. I mean, of course, here we've got fire stations. It says here it could be up to 85 fire stations in the southwest gone. That's shocking, and it is mostly the public services taking the hit. And that's, of course, because they don't work for profit. They kind of work in the interest of the public rather than in the interest of themselves.
Well, let's cross our fingers and hope that we're going to have some of the financial sector taking a hit rather than the public sector in the future.
Well, yes. I mean, the public sector is... it's exactly that. It's a public sector. It's for the public. I mean, I don't know whether the millionaires in the Conservative government have ever had much to do with the public sector other than occasionally calling an ambulance when they've had an injury.
Okay, Jason, well, thanks very much. See you next week.
Thank you, Tony.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 22nd of February, the ZZ Tops will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 PM. Also on 22nd of February, Three Kings High will be performing with support at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 8 PM. On to Song of the Week, and I present Five Finger Death Punch. This group formed in Los Angeles, United States in 2005 and to date have released three studio albums and several singles. This is from the album War is the Answer, which was released in 2009 and is the song Far From Home.
Another day in this carnival of souls. Another night sets in as quickly as it goes. The memories are shadows, echo the page, and I can't seem to find my way home. And it's almost like your heaven's trying everything. Your heaven's trying everything to keep me out. All the places I've been and things I've seen, a million stories that made up a million shattered dreams.
Five Finger Death Punch with Far From Home from the album War Is The Answer. For more information, you can check out www.fivefingerdeathpunch.com. Into Saturday, 23rd of February, Phil King will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £7 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, into Sunday, 24th of February, The Union, who feature Luke Morley of Thunder fame and Peter Shoulder of Wintervale fame, will be performing with support from Black Wolf at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Before you go, Jeff, War Is The Answer.
Well, not really, but that's about...
I think maybe there's a little bit of irony in there.
Yes, must be.
Okay, thanks a lot. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're listening online, I am doing the BCFM Politics Show. That's Friday Drive Time every Friday from 5 to 7pm or on FM. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which reminds you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests this week. That's Ben Luton, Sabine McNeil, and the former mayor candidate for Bristol, Tony Britt. Dialect's a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye.
That you can build them up.